Hello, and welcome to Partners in Diplomacy, a podcast series exploring the service, sacrifice, and adventure of life as a Foreign Service family member. I'm your host today, Mark Rincon, and we're joined by Bonnie Miller, a psychotherapist, professor, training facilitator, social activist, and the usual host of this podcast series, who accompanied her husband, Tom, to many postings during his 29-year Foreign Service career. Welcome, Bonnie. It's great to have you here, and especially on the other side of the microphone. We're glad to have you share your experiences and your knowledge.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you, Mark.
So, Bonnie, if we could, let's start with your childhood. You were born in Chicago in 1948, and then you moved to the Chicago suburbs in kindergarten. Can you tell us about your family and what it was like growing up in the 50s and in the 60s?
I had kind of an unremarkable and normal childhood. I am the oldest of five children. We moved to that house in Glencoe, which is a very small suburb on the North Shore of Chicago, in 1954. And my family stayed there up until 4 years ago. And my mother just sold the house in 2017. It was a comfortable and secure and safe suburban life. But we were also close enough to Chicago, especially in my teenage years when I was dating, that we could go downtown to a movie, or we could go to museums, or we could go to baseball games. And also, Glencoe was right on Lake Michigan. So in the summers, we would hang out at the beach with our friends a lot.
That is interesting. And speaking of baseball, how did you meet your husband, Tom? And when did you get married? If you could share a bit, please.
We sat next to each other in Spanish class. So one day in April, he turned to me and said, "Hey, I've got tickets for the White Sox opening game. Do you want to go with me? You'd have to cut class to do it." And I said, "Yeah, sure." So he had a note from his father excusing him. I didn't. We went to the game. We had a great time. And I got in trouble, but it was worth it. And then we became friends for that spring. We cut school a lot. I figured out how to do it. And for the spring and for the summer, we were just really good friends. But then by the fall, when we were making college visits, I realized that I missed him. And it was more than that. So for senior year, we were a couple, and we decided that we would both go to University of Michigan together. And then after junior year at Michigan, when we were 20 years old, we got married.
Well, you and Tom, you attended the University of Michigan in the late 60s. It's a very interesting time period. How was that environment different from where you grew up? And what did you study as Wolverines when you were at the university?
My childhood prior to that was pretty placid. We got to Michigan and it was a complete culture shock. There were Motown songs playing everywhere. There were anti-war protests. There were teach-ins and sit-ins and civil rights and activism. And it was really a happening place. I studied psychology, and with those courses, there was a lot of outreach from University of Michigan, so I wound up being a teaching fellow my senior year and in graduate school, and we brought students to an institution near Ann Arbor where there were kids with behavioral problems and mild intellectual disabilities, and so my students would kind of befriend them and be mentors toward them. I also did outreach in Chicago in between my years at Michigan, starting with anti-poverty programs like Head Start. And then between my sophomore and junior years, I worked at the Neighborhood Youth Corps program, which was for kids from Mexico, migrant children whose parents were working in the fields in what is now suburban Chicago, but what was then very rural areas. And I got summer jobs for the kids, and then we did field trips on Fridays, which was fun. Then the next year, I went downtown to Chicago to the main office and worked on programs for Neighborhood Youth Corps, this time mostly with African American inner city kids. And so that was kind of my first brush with social work. So I got my BA in psychology, and then I went on right after undergrad to get my master's in social work at University of Michigan. That was another complete culture shock. My first job in Michigan was as a school social worker. The place that I worked was about 45 minutes away from Ann Arbor, but a cultural chasm away from Ann Arbor. It was in Howell, Michigan, and they had just started a school social work program, and we were the first social workers. And this was a place that was the headquarters of the Ku Klux Klan of Michigan and the John Birch Society, far right of Michigan. I had a high school, a middle school, and four elementary schools. The culture was very different. It was completely white. And at the time, they believed in corporal punishment. It was really out of my framework. I did a lot of teacher training, a consultation, working with parents, and the kids were terrific.
Could you tell me a little bit about how you made that joint decision for Tom to join the Foreign Service?
Well, his father was in Japan for half of his childhood. His father was a businessman, so he always had an international interest. Unlike him, I had never been on an airplane until I graduated high school. I always had an interest in other cultures, a love of adventure. So he decided to take the Foreign Service exam when he was 20 in his senior year. And he passed the written and he passed the oral. And they said, okay, so when are you coming into the Foreign Service? And he said, well, first I'd like to get a PhD. They said, call us back in 5 years. So that's what he did. He took the exam again, the oral, the written, he passed it. And in 1976, he came into the Foreign Service. So we kind of had two different lifestyles. One was the overseas component, but in Fairfax County, Virginia, in Springfield, where we lived, we had kind of a normal life. I was a psychotherapist in private practice with two groups of pediatricians, two different psychiatrists. I taught social work at George Mason University and raised the kid. Tom was commuting from Springfield downtown to DC in the State Department. So that was our life in the suburbs. We chose as our first posting Chiang Mai, Thailand, because he had done his field work in Konkan, Thailand, a very small place where nobody spoke English. So it was natural when he was offered a job at the consulate in Chiang Mai, Thailand, that we said, yeah, let's go. Chiang Mai is so much better than Konkan. We should do this. So it was really joint decisions for overseas postings. He could do whatever he wanted in the department, but I was looking at schools when our children got to be old enough, and it was a big discussion about where we would be posted for 2 or 3 years.
Just remind me, when and where were your children born?
I came to Washington when I was 6 months pregnant with our daughter, Julie, who was born here in D.C. in 1976, and we had our second child in January of 1979, Eric.
And your first posting as a family was in Chiang Mai in Thailand with the small children, 1979 to 1981. Can you tell us a little bit about how was life there as a family?
Chiang Mai, Thailand in 1979 to 81 was nothing like it is now. It's a huge tourist haven. It's just booming and bustling, and they have massage classes and cooking classes and all sorts of stuff and many, many foreigners. It was not like that at all back then. Hardly anybody spoke English. There were very few stores or restaurants. The main mode of transportation was bicycle samlors, which are pedicabs. It was a real quaint small town. It had beautiful weather, so that was great for our kids. They could be outside year round. And it was a wonderful first posting, and both of us had language and we made friends there. The downside was we were really removed from civilization in terms of communication. There was no internet. We had no TV. We had the Bangkok Post, which once a week said the hostages are still in Iran. And that was really our only news. So we were very cut off from the rest of the world. I decided that I would try to get a job teaching psychology. And so I taught at Chiang Mai University, which was really fun. My students were terrific, and so were the other professors. And then the consulate and the embassy hired me to write a manual for expatriates. So how to get along in Chiang Mai, something about the culture, the holidays, where to go and buy things, things to do. And one of Tom's duties as a consular officer, he did go to refugee camps. And this was right after the Vietnam War. The refugee camps were housing mostly Hmong refugees from Laos. And so we visited them and heard their stories. He also had a temporary duty, TDY, in Songkhla, which is in southern Thailand. And there we visited a refugee camp for the Vietnamese boat people who were coming in very, very perilous journey. We talked to survivors, some of whom had been raped, all of whom had been robbed by Thai pirates. So they really had a harrowing journey trying to get from communist Vietnam to the United States. When we went to Chiang Mai, I had no idea whether there would be a preschool for my three-year-old, Julie. And the first week I was there, this wonderful woman came to our house and said, "I'm running a preschool. It's an American preschool. My daughter will be in the preschool, and I'd love for Julie to come." So Julie had a terrific preschool experience, and I had a best friend. Her name was Joyce Powers. So that was the upside, the great news. The downside was that Joyce Powers was kidnapped and murdered a little over a year after we got there. Her husband was the head of DEA. She was kidnapped with her three-year-old child and murdered at point-blank range. And so that was October of 1980. And we didn't know at first whether it was a drug thing, whether it was a robbery thing. I didn't take my kids out for a month. It was just traumatic for everybody. So that was how it ended. We kind of laid low for the last 9 months. The first year plus was terrific, and then there was this pall of sadness and tragedy over the last months.
That is quite the first tour. You sacrificed and experienced so much. I understand then after that you came back to Washington, D.C., had 4 years in Washington, D.C. For that domestic assignment. And then as a family, you all moved again overseas, this time to Athens, Greece, in 1985 to 1987. How was life there for you and your family?
That was a terrific posting, and it was chosen by us because I had researched the schools, and they had an excellent elementary school. Our kids were in first grade and fourth grade. And so the whole experience turned out to be terrific, just learning about Greece and traveling and making friends. The State Department, for a very short time, had a grant for a mental health program coordinator. And so I was asked if I would do that. And that was a lot of fun, hardly paid anything, but I worked with the CLO and I did mental health workshops on depression or anxiety or substance abuse, also cross-cultural adjustment. I ran a teen group of American kids. So that was a really fun part-time job. And then I also got a job consulting at the American School. And doing parenting education groups. They didn't have money to pay me. I said, "You're getting rid of your Olympic-sized trampoline. I'll take that in lieu of payment." My two kids and I learned how to jump on the trampoline and do flips. Another thing about Greece was that my husband and one other person were in this two-person Greek class at FSI, the Foreign Service Institute, for 10 months before going to Greece. And this other man was Bill Nordine. He was a Navy captain, and he was posted to the embassy. So we were good friends with him and his family. He had a daughter who was the same age as our daughter. We did a lot of traveling with them and celebrated holidays with them. So we left and we said goodbye to them. They had one more year in Greece. And then my husband was working in the counterterrorism office in Washington, D.C., when he got a call in the middle of the night saying that Bill Nordine had been car bombed and had died. So that was our second post. our second time when our best friend was murdered by terrorists. And so Tom went over there immediately to help Bill's wife, Trish, and his daughter, Annabelle, and help them pack out.
Wow, that is quite the experience. And there weren't the kinds of resources available today. Just such a difficult experience for your first two assignments. I understand then, after another 7 years in Washington, you came back. You worked again during this time as a psychotherapist and a social work professor at George Mason University. You and the family had a chance to move back overseas and back to Athens, where Tom was a deputy chief of mission from 1994 to 1997.
It was so comfortable going back there. We had friends from before. We knew the culture. We had the language. Julie was at college during that time, so she would come visit. Eric was now in high school, in 10th grade, at the same school where he had started elementary school. And I actually worked at his school again. They asked me to create a substance abuse prevention curriculum from grades kindergarten through 12. I was asked to teach at the University of Indianapolis, in Athens in downtown, which was an American college. And I decided that it was time to improve my Greek. And so I took Greek language on the island of Paros. It was through college year in Athens, which is a wonderful, wonderful study abroad program for college students. Tom was DCM. We had a lot more representational activities. We met a lot more people. It was a busy time and a fun time.
So after 2 years back in D.C. again, Tom was offered the ambassadorship to Bosnia and Herzegovina. How was life for you and the family in Sarajevo? You were there from 1999 to 2001. Is that right?
So in those two intervening years, Tom was the Cyprus coordinator, and he was working with Richard Holbrooke to solve the Cyprus problem. So he was commuting between Washington, Brussels, Athens, Turkey, and Cyprus. Then he got offered that ambassadorship in Sarajevo. We had never been to former Yugoslavia. It was a totally different thing. And it was a life-changing experience. We got there less than 3 years after the war had ended with the Dayton Accords, and saw the devastation, the destruction, the trauma of the people. The CLO made an introduction for me to the University of Sarajevo. I hadn't applied, but they offered me a position teaching English. They said I could teach anything I wanted as long as I could speak American English. So I had three classes. I had 115 students. These kids had been in junior high during the war. Many had been refugees. Many had been displaced. Some had been under siege in Sarajevo. And we talked about their stories. All they had to do was speak American English. And it was very interactive class, but I learned a lot from my student. I also was teaching at the University of Maryland University College, which is now University of Maryland Global Campus. And that was at the base at Butmir outside of Sarajevo. I realized since they were not allowed into Sarajevo, they were pretty much on base, that they really didn't have a real concept of what their mission was and how important they were to keeping the peace in Bosnia after the war. So I decided to create a course called Psychosocial Consequences of War. And this course was about how the 3.5 year war in Bosnia affected all segments of the population, from children to elderly to people who were displaced to couples who were in mixed marriages. And so I developed this course and I taught it at Butmir, and they sent me around to teach at various other bases. I taught it at FSI, so I wanted to emphasize the consequences and the effects of the war on regular people, because this was really not just a war of combatants, but a war against civilians. I also had the opportunity to work with a lot of NGOs. Everybody was inviting me all over the country. They wanted to show me their programs. And also some of the NGOs had a lot of things to give away. So another NGO that I worked with, I was on their board, was called Peace Trails. They were training young entrepreneurs to start different projects. I also started the Bosnian chapter of Seeds of Peace. Seeds of Peace was started by a friend of mine, Chris Covey, and her friend, Lindsay Miller, Aaron Miller's wife, to work with kids from conflict areas. These kids were 14, 15, 16 years old. They were future leaders, and they would bring them to a camp in Maine. So we started the program in Bosnia. I chose the kids, and they went to Maine. Well, I did that for 2 years. But I said, what's really needed in Bosnia is not for them to meet people from other countries, as interesting as that would be, and just to choose maybe a dozen kids. What's really needed in Bosnia is for youth to interact with kids of other ethnicities within Bosnia on a larger scale, because society was getting more and more separated after the war. And so I wanted to get these kids together to do a similar kind of program, but I didn't have any money for it. And the first Dayton Peace Prize was given to Bill Clinton, but he couldn't keep the money, obviously. So he called us and said, you and Tom can decide on what to do with my $25,000 Peace Prize award. So I started Youth for Peace. We did camps. UN ran the program, and it got these kids together, these kids who spoke the same language, liked the same music, had the same culture, basically, but were kind of being drawn apart in their schooling and by their parents. And that was a wonderful program. I also started doing adoption home studies for Americans who wanted to adopt foreign children. Mark Grossman, who had adopted a child in Turkey, was ambassador at the time, and he invited me to come to Ankara and to do interviews with Americans who wanted to adopt children from various countries, Russia or China or Jamaica even. And so that started on my career of doing these very comprehensive adoption home studies, and that was very gratifying to me. I decided that it wouldn't be difficult to write a parenting manual for Bosnia and Herzegovina. It was basically about how to communicate with your child, how to recognize the strengths in your child, how to discipline without using physical discipline. And so another NGO came and gave me $1,000 and said, take the show on the road. So I started doing workshops. Then the Minister of Education in Bosnia-Herzegovina asked me to write a similar manual for educators, for teachers and administrators. And so I wrote an educational manual about how to use active learning, how to make education relevant, how to discipline without using force, how to make learning fun. It was discovered at Bootmere Base by PSYOPS. And PSYOPS funded this book because I never wanted to charge for my books. And of course, I never made any money from it. So they did it. And that started me on the road to educational workshops that I did all over Bosnia-Herzegovina and then expanded to the rest of the world. One of the most interesting things that I did in Bosnia was that I had a lot of this stuff from NGOs, and I had a lot of clothing in small sizes from the base at Bootmere. I was friends with somebody who worked for the International Organization on Migration, and I said, you can have all this stuff. And she said, well, we heard that you are a psychotherapist. Would you like to come to our shelter that has rescued women survivors of trafficking? I went to the shelter and I just listened. I heard the stories of these teenage girls and young women. Some were mothers, some were just 16 years old. They had all been deceived. They had all been told that they could be waitresses in Italy. And instead, they wound up in bars in Bosnia and Herzegovina as sex slaves. Because I was the wife of the ambassador, people wanted to interview me. People wanted to know about trafficking. And so I really could get the word out there about these young girls and how abused they were and what their plight was. So that was the beginning of my work on counter-trafficking starting in Bosnia.
Wow, that is an excellent experience. And I detect a theme in this career for you, that each and every assignment, every time you were in a new place, you sought to make a positive difference. And in that sense, you were at the right place at the right time. So after that experience, you and Tom made a direct transfer back to Athens, where Tom was the ambassador from 2001 through 2004. That period included the Olympics.
So we had 1 month in Washington between Sarajevo and Athens. We were supposed to do a refresher course in Greek, and the second day of the refresher course was 9/11, 2001. So we were at the Foreign Service Institute. We were evacuated. That was a weird time to be in Washington. We arrived in Greece at the end of September of 2001. So this time I was the ambassador's spouse at a big embassy, and I really had two parts to my life. One was the official. There was a lot of entertaining. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. The other part of my life was work. So I went back to teaching at the University of Indianapolis in downtown Athens. I taught psychology there. And almost immediately after I arrived, a wonderful NGO called Doctors of the World learned of my work in Bosnia, and they were working with refugees, and they were starting programs to help women victims of trafficking. So I worked with them, and that was just a wonderful experience for the 3+ years that we were there. I did a lot of advocacy and public awareness. I spoke at a lot of conferences, and so I could get the word out there that these women are not paid prostitutes. They are instead sex slaves, and they're not earning any money, and they're not able to get out. And they are locked into bars and apartments and made to service many, many men every night. So then we transitioned into actually helping the survivors, starting a shelter through Doctors of the World, and also pushing for legislation. This was right after the TIP report, the Trafficking in Persons report, came out through the State Department that they do every year, and they rate every country on how they're doing on various aspects of counter-trafficking, from prevention to prosecution of the Johns and the bar owners, to protection of the women. So we lobbied very hard for Greece to have legislation. I worked with the number twos in every ministry. Tom worked with the ministers themselves. And I decided I will write some suggestions for each ministry of what they can do for this prevention, prosecution, and protection. And then months later, they came out with their national action plan of Greece in Greek. And I looked it over and I said, this sounds familiar. I wrote all this stuff in English. They translated it into Greek and they made it the national action plan against trafficking. So they were moving forward and things were getting better. Another project that I did in Greece was after teaching at the pedagogical academies in Bosnia, in Sarajevo and Mostar, I realized that most teachers did not have any clue what learning difficulties were. So I invited a friend from New York to come to Athens right after 9/11, where he was at ground zero, and to help me make a video. So together we made a video on learning disabilities and attention deficit disorders. What is it? What does it look like? And what teachers can do to help? So that was used for training for educators in Greece and in Cyprus, and I eventually took it all over the world. It was translated into many languages. Also, I found some funding for college for some Bosnian and Kosovar kids who wanted to go to college in Greece, and got them through 4 years of college. These were kids who had suffered through wars. Some had lost parents, some had been displaced. And by putting the arm on friends and different organizations and the universities themselves, I sponsored 8 terrific students in Greece. And now most of them have gone on for master's degrees and they're in their mid-30s and are very successful. We did a lot of embassy morale work. I worked with the CLO, and we did newcomers orientations, which we had started actually when my husband was DCM, and we continued them in Sarajevo when he was ambassador. We also had some community outreach projects. We work with Father Andonis, a Greek priest who was working with hundreds of children who were refugees. We worked with Habitat for Humanity, rehabbing some places, worked with refugees, and that got people involved, maybe didn't speak the language, embassy folks. I continued my work with Training Workshops International and doing multi-ethnic workshops for educators and staffs of orphanages. I kept going back to Bosnia-Herzegovina with them and also started doing similar work for educators in Kosovo through a terrific NGO that worked there. So at the end of our time in Athens, it was the Olympics, and it was truly the golden age of Greece. They had a new metro system, a new airport, new buildings. The venues were amazing. Literally, the paint was still drying as the opening ceremony was going on. The Greeks got it all done at the end and had a wonderful Olympics, something they could be really proud of. And the whole world saw what a success it was.
Wow, what a time. Your husband later then retired from the Foreign Service officially then in December 2004. So what did you two do after that?
We bought a house in Old Town Alexandria. We thought we would come back and have a normal American life, but he applied for a job as the CEO of Plan International, which is a huge organization helping children in 49 developing countries. So we moved to Woking, England, which is not London, but we were rarely there anyway, because between my work going back to Bosnia and Kosovo and our visits to planned program countries, we were rarely actually in England. They had wonderful programs in education and child protection and health in 49 countries. I went to 41 countries of planned programs, and then they asked me to do workshops for their staff on child protection or education, mental health. So I did that in all different countries. At the end of our time, our 4 years in the UK, I was asked to go to Republic of Georgia. It was right after the Russian invasion of South Ossetia in 2008, and I was asked by the embassy to come and work with educators and mental health specialists. And that was a fabulous group who themselves were traumatized, but who were trying to help others who had been displaced by the Russians from South Ossetia.
Okay, so you returned after that to Washington, D.C. area, where you've lived since early 2005. What have you been doing since you've gotten back?
What I've been doing is kind of being divided between work at home in this region and international work. I went right back to George Mason University. They had started a graduate school of social work since I left. And so I taught there and I developed their internships for their students so that they could work with clients. And I also, from 2014 to 2019, I worked at University of Maryland Graduate School of Social Work, and I was supervising their interns working with clients. I did a lot of volunteer work. I started literally in our neighborhood, about a block away, which is low-income housing in Old Town Alexandria. I worked with a wonderful project called the Reading Connection. And we would go in and work with the little kids, read them stories, kind of broaden their horizons, do crafts with them. Since I got back, been working at our local homeless shelter in Old Town Alexandria, doing volunteer work. For years, I worked as an American Red Cross disaster mental health worker. Now I'm doing the American Red Cross reconnection project, which I'm a facilitator, and we're working with military, doing workshops on communication and stress management. But my international work has always been fascinating. I was accepted as a Fulbright Senior Specialist Speaker, so my first stint was teaching at the American University of Central Asia in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan. They had just had an ethnic conflict between the Kyrgyz people and the Uzbek people in another part of that country in Osh. So they sent me down to do mental health workshops for the mental health workers who were working with the traumatized people there. Then my second teaching stint was at Southeast Europe University in Tetovo in Macedonia. I also went back to Republic of Georgia in 2010 and met with similar people who had been displaced. Now they were not in refugee centers. They were in homes, not as nice as their old ones, but they were adjusting to being back in Georgia. They realized they could never go back to South Ossetia because the Russians had taken over. So I did mental health workshops. Again, another fabulous group of facilitators. Since then, I've had a bunch of different positions that I never applied for. The International Relief and Development, IRD, asked me to do mental health training in Iraqi Kurdistan. It was a training for trainers. I had a Kurdish group and an Arabic-speaking group of educators, administrators, and mental health personnel. So I went there for about 3 weeks, and I did training on helping with trauma, helping with mental health issues. They'd all been traumatized, the facilitators, the people they were working with, because Iraq had been at war for so much time. The next project was in Afghanistan. This was a staff care workshop. I went back twice, and these were not mental health professionals, and these were not touchy-feely educators. They were supervising construction projects to rebuild Afghanistan, but they were locked down. They lived and worked in the same place because it was no longer safe as it had been before to go to a taverna, go to a store or whatever in Kabul. Then a close friend of mine at Columbia University Institute for Peacebuilding and Rights asked me if I wanted to be a facilitator on conflict resolution and social harmony. My colleague at Columbia was a young woman who had degrees in this and had written a fabulous curriculum on conflict resolution and social harmony. So we just tweaked it for the various places that we went, and we co-facilitated workshops. And we went to places like Sri Lanka several times, North Macedonia, Aceh, after they had had a 26-year civil war, same in Sri Lanka, 29-year civil war. And the last one was a conflict resolution in Myanmar, which I facilitated myself. I also got involved in the SEED project, S-E-E-D, in Iraqi Kurdistan to help Yazidis work through their trauma after they had been kidnapped and many raped by ISIS in Iraq. In 2014, I was invited to develop a curriculum for social workers working with these populations who have gotten out from ISIS. So I developed a curriculum for them. They also brought me to Koya University near Erbil, and I developed a clinical psychology curriculum for all 4 years for that university so that their students could actually have the classes and have the internships and have the skills when they graduated to be able to go out and work with traumatized populations in addition to working at psychiatric hospitals and other places, schools, for instance. So the next project that I was asked to do was called Room to Read. This is a terrific project working in 8 developing countries, helping girls get through high school from 6th grade, and they have mentors who are helping them with different life skills like conflict resolution, communications, applying for jobs, study skills. And so they asked me to work with their mentors on wellness. And so I developed a curriculum. They had hundreds of mentors and thousands of girls, and it was just a wonderful program. Tom and I were asked to teach at a university in Beijing. In 2015, we team taught a course on the Balkans. It was all interactive, which was something that was very different for these Chinese students who were juniors and seniors, and they had had mostly teaching by rote memorization. So I retired from University of Maryland in 2019, and since then, I've been with my grandchildren who are in the area and just watching them grow. I edited several books. I love to travel, and then the pandemic came. I'm an amateur photographer. I love going to new places and taking pictures, so I'm hoping to do that again. I was asked in my oral interview, so what else is next? And I'm like, well, things always come up. You never know. And sure enough, ADST asked me to be a podcast interviewer for this group of podcasts with spouses of Foreign Service officers. And so this has been tons of fun doing interviews with spouses like myself.
Well, Bonnie, I think it's clear that any objective onlooker would see that even in retirement, you've been very active and have made many contributions. And for that, we're grateful for that experience. So thinking back, has your Foreign Service experience given you any opportunities, whether personal or professional, that you wouldn't have enjoyed if you had stayed in the United States?
And the answer is yes, absolutely. As I said, when I was in the United States, I was leading a pretty suburban life. But my Foreign Service experience has enabled me to travel, learn different languages, see different cultures, make friends, both American and foreign. Cooperation with NGOs has been fantastic. My counter-trafficking and being able to have a platform for the advocacy that I did on that. The educational and mental health seminars that I've done all over the world give me access to large audiences. The adoption home studies, and it just gave me a background to adapt to working in foreign settings for my work with Plan International and giving workshops with them.
Great. Well, we're nearing the end of our session. I'd like to know, do you have any final thoughts, lessons learned, words of wisdom, or advice for spouses whose partners are considering a career in the Foreign Service? What would be realistic expectations of a career in the Foreign Service for a spouse?
Since 1976, when my husband joined, there have been so many changes in the Foreign Service and in society. And one of them is the internet. And so now it enables remote working and learning, also communication with friends and family that we never had, especially our first post, and keeping up on the news. So it's easier to be overseas. My words of wisdom from our 29 years in the Foreign Service and after is be curious, be in a learning mode, be flexible and open to new experiences. Use your strengths and be optimistic. Define success differently. It may not be how you defined it when you were living in the United States. Don't try to plan for several postings ahead. Things come up and you turn out to be in a whole different situation. Don't expect a linear career with ready-made job and regular promotions and a big salary at each post. Some people have done it, most people have not. Sometimes you just have to make your own opportunities. Examine the needs in the community and use your initiative and creativity, and sometimes that can be the most gratifying experience. Try to learn the local language. It really makes a difference. Volunteer work and jobs outside of your field and locally can be very enriching. The embassy provides a supportive community, but don't just stick with embassy Americans. Do get involved with local experiences. The State Department now provides resources, retraining grants, closed services, courses, language training, and take advantage of that. Each post is different. You can reinvent yourself according to your own and your family's needs. And what a lot of people don't realize is Washington is a post too. And reentry may be difficult for you and especially for your kids if they've lived overseas their whole lives. Also, take care of yourself, mind and body, wellness, exercise, stay healthy, and ask for help if you need it. And now that's easier to do with remote therapy and other resources. So that's my advice for people who are considering this career.
Wise words indeed. Bonnie, thank you so much for sharing your stories about your Foreign Service experience.
Thank you for listening. If you are curious to learn more about the lives of Foreign Service family members, subscribe and listen to additional episodes in our Partners in Diplomacy series. To learn more about the experiences of America's diplomats and diplomacy, visit our website at adst.org or check us out on Twitter and Facebook. The Partners in Diplomacy podcast is funded by the Una Chapman Cox Foundation. Our theme music is We Are One by Scott Holmes. Our assistant producer is Sumaya Ishrat. Our producers are James Fowler and Mark Rincon. Our audio engineering and post-production are provided by James Fowler and Post Productions. My name is Bonnie Miller. Until next time.